I'm not going to read from the book. Every time I've tried that, and I've only tried it twice, I feel like I'm back in the second grade, and Betsy Kling is next to me in her seat, and she's rolling her eyes while I stumble through some sentence. So I'm just going to talk, and I hope for not more than a half an hour, and be happy to take questions that people might have about, or not even questions, just comments, screams, shrieks about organized labor or the 1% or whatever you want to talk about. I titled this book, Only One Thing Can Save Us, because I really do believe that contrary to all the public policy debate that was going on, oh, we have inadequate education, or the government isn't doing this, or we aren't stimulating this, the one thing that wasn't in the public policy debate, and that's starting to change a little bit, was how absolutely crucial it is to have collective bargaining in order to save what is left of the middle class. If you're talking about wage stagnation, the disinvestment of people for lack of job training, just 100 ways in which the middle class is affected, not least of which a sense of efficacy in our lives, a sense of engagement. The way to bring that back is to create an institution that represents people in terms of wages, hours, working conditions, but also job training, their way of life, and the political sphere. It's the answer, I believe, don't laugh, to everything. And yet it's the one thing that the political class seems just unable to discuss. It's not in our politics. Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and all of them seem to live in some sort of bubble. They talk about things that don't affect people's real lives. That's why I use that kind of draconian apocalyptic title. But it's not a matter of bringing back organized labor. You can't resuscitate it. I truly believe that the organized labor that we have now, and to which I'm devoted, and which pays me money, and which I love in many ways, is gone. And it is both a tragedy and a great opportunity to put something different back in place. So I was going to start this talk by using the old Dickens line, Tale of Two Cities, it's the best of times, worst of times, for organized labor. For organized labor, it is most certainly the worst of times. And if it's not in any way the best of times, there are a couple of encouraging things that are happening. Let's talk about the worst of times. At the moment, right-to-work laws are spreading, even in the Midwest. Now, we'll just say, most of you probably know what right-to-work laws are, but these are laws that bar the unions from charging their members anything. Dues, fair share, which is less than dues, it's a concept that excludes political activities, nickels, dimes, anything. So that when these laws are in place, typically union contributions decline a lot. So it's not just that unions are representing now only 6.6% of the private sector, but it's not even getting money from that 6.6%. 26 of our 50 states, plus the federal government, have right-to-work laws. That is, the people in those states don't have to and often don't contribute anything to the unions whatsoever. So what is happening as this spreads just last year in Wisconsin, private sector, Michigan, Indiana. Michigan, of all places, is now a right-to-work state, like Mississippi. While that spreads, it's defunding what is left of the labor movement. It's running out of money. Now, I don't think it's coming from any groundswell of popular outrage over union dues. I think this is really run coming out of three phenomena. Number one is the incredible gerrymandering of the states, including those particular states that have moved to right-to-work laws. The gerrymandering in our time is just much worse than it has been historically. So the Republicans have large majorities in state legislatures in ways that they haven't had in the past. Second, the Koch brothers are funding this, Competitive Enterprise Institute and so forth. And it's labor has made some very stupid decisions about how to fight this. So for those three reasons, these right-to-work laws are spreading. And there's cases that are coming before the Supreme Court to knock out the obligation to pay dues entirely in the public sector, in the other 24 states where it still exists. The more the right tinkers with the model that exists, which has served the right very well. It's very hard to organize under the Wagner Act because there aren't any sanctions against employers when they violate the laws. The whole system is set up to make it hard to organize. This whole model has served the right very well, but they keep tinkering with it, making it worse, and the whole thing may collapse, really, within the next 5 or 6 years, certainly if the Supreme Court outlaws the collection of dues altogether. In addition to that, it's the worst of times for the people who are in those unions and outside of the unions, the whole middle class. You know, look at the big stat on wage stagnation. Since 1979, GDP has gone up 150%. Productivity per worker has gone up an astonishing 75%. And income, wages, has gone up, the median hourly wage has gone up 5%. And probably, if you took out what is the tiny, tiny, tiny bit that is the union sector, it's probably in negative numbers for the non-union middle class. And that's the least of it. It's always frustrating to me, this whole wage stagnation debate, that people talk about that hourly wage or straight out compensation. From my point of view, as somebody who represents not just unions, but employee groups and started out as an ERISA lawyer, ERISA is the big federal pension law, the big cutback has been, colossal cutback has been in pensions. Defined benefit pensions, which used to cover just about everybody who worked at a company that was over 500 employees in the United States, have now practically disappeared. And they have been replaced in some attenuated way by 401ks, but the average 401k for those small minority that have them now really reaps about an average of $100,000 upon retirement, which is an annuity of about $500 a month to live on. That's been an enormous transfer of wealth from the middle class to the 1%. The second, and I think bigger disinvestment that has been going on and is accelerating now and is especially affecting young people, is the disinvestment in people as human capital. And I spend a long part of this book talking about what that means. Despite all the blather about job training and all of that, there's less and less of it going on, necessarily so, because we don't have employers anymore. You know, when I started out, I was really concerned that people didn't have pensions or the same benefits as they used to as companies folded. Then I got concerned that people didn't have unions or representation at all. And now, in the last part of my life as a labor lawyer, maybe the very, very, very last part of it, they don't have employers. You have people who have been spun off as independent contractors. You have people who are working as temps. And you have enormous amounts of subcontracting. David Weil, a professor at Boston University, was a professor. He's now the head of the Wage Hour Division, has written a book called The Fissured Workplace. And the thesis of this book, and it's something that I was writing about, I'm happy to say independently of him, and is that these companies have dissolved. Everything is contracted out. The result is that there aren't classifications, there isn't a career ladder anymore. Even if you're in a company now, there's not the same career ladder, and it's quite possible that as you go along, you will be contracted out. That is, you will find yourself spun off to another corporation if you're not spun off as an independent contractor, if you're not spun off as a temp. And this is happening to a greater and greater extent, and especially it happens with the young, and it happens with people in college. I used to think of the temp phenomenon, the independent contractor phenomenon, as something that was for day laborers. But now it's for college graduates. If I can tell a family story, my own nephew, you know, science, technology, et cetera, he's got 2 degrees in biology and chemistry, goes to work for a pharmaceutical company. The only way you can get in the door now is as a temp. And you have to work your way out of temp status and hope you get lucky and land a real job. He happened to. And he told his company where he was working as a temp, you know, I'm leaving. I've actually got a real job now with a real employer. And the company said, oh, what kind of loyalty do you show to us? You know, that And in my own profession, law, there are fewer and fewer law graduates who are getting jobs at real law firms as employers. They're working as essentially as temps, contract lawyers. Look at the university that they come out of. You know, the university is a perfect paradigm of the American workplace because it's all being spun out to independent contractors, adjunct professors to do the teaching. And these tenured jobs, which are decent and great and something that we should salute and protect, are shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. That's the world that these young people are coming out of. And they are, demographically, that demographic, if you go from 79 to the present, that 5% wage increase, it doesn't apply to them. They are actually making less. Think about that for a second. Here are people in the 20 to 30 bracket, more diplomas than at any time in history, and they're making less than people did in my demographic, in real terms, adjusted terms, from back in the 70s. That is going to continue. You will read in newspapers from time to time, oh, there was wage growth last month, or there's wage growth this year. It's not going to be a straight line down. It'll be squiggly. But the long term, that wonderful word, secular, long term prognosis is stagnation, stagnation, and decline. So the decline is not just wages. It's not just the reduction, complete disappearance of pensions. It's not just being spun off as temps where you don't make even Social Security, so there's absolutely no retirement facing you. It's not just that. It's the disinvestment in this highly educated generation that is in the 20 or more educated generation that is in the 20 to 30 bracket. We talk about community colleges, skilling people up. That's in the community college sense. That's for 2 years. That's for 2 years. We don't talk about the fact that there's a complete disinvestment for the next 40. That is, there isn't, as there was 50 or 60 years ago, a mentoring system. There isn't anybody to watch their backs. There isn't apprenticeships. There aren't the things that unions used to do, which is, hey, kid, don't take drugs because they're having the test tomorrow, or straighten your life out. There's nobody like that. And that's the world that younger people are coming out into. Older people, they're a threat to them. The 65 to 75 bracket, you know, a couple of years ago, 18% of them were working, essentially full time. That number is going up to 32%. And that's being driven not because we're all in such wonderful health, which is the way some in the press like to spin it. It's being driven overwhelmingly because people don't have any savings. There aren't the defined pension benefit plans. So as the baby boom generation comes along and replaces that world that used to get some sort of defined benefit plans, you'll see a bigger and bigger increase in people 65 to 75 working. I'm always annoyed, no end, when there are these stories about, oh, globalization is holding us back, automation is the threat. There's no threat for younger people coming along that is greater than this huge increase in older people who are going to be holding onto their jobs. That means they can't move up a notch. The college kids who are in non-college jobs aren't going to move over into college jobs. Everybody's going to is going to be held further back at a time when college debt is increasing. It's a very nasty situation. And the political class, or the political elite in this country, up until very recently, hasn't been talking about it at all. None of this is on the radar. None of this gets discussed. And you wonder why younger people think that politics doesn't matter. In one sense, there couldn't be a bigger difference between the Democrats and the Republicans as there is today. And in another sense, it must seem like it doesn't matter at all. And I'm putting aside gridlock, which is another reason why politics doesn't seem to matter. It's just the lack of focus of the Democratic Party on this problem. For years and years and years, they have been saying that the only answer to inequality is more education. Well, that is the good news. The good news is that that stupid message, which demoralized 70% of the country that doesn't have college degrees because the Democrats were saying there's no hope for you, that is starting to change a little bit. And you see signs of it. I mean, Paul Krugman wrote a column the other day about how education isn't the problem, but Paul Krugman isn't the The best exemplar of this is the former Secretary of Treasury in the Clinton administration, president of Harvard. He got chased out, but he's still around. Larry Summers, who has been saying, you know what, it's not, education isn't the problem, government policy isn't the problem, we need to bring back labor unions. For Larry Summers to be saying that publicly and forcefully, as he has been, is a sign of change in the wind. Barack Obama actually mentioned unions slightly. You had to listen very carefully in his State of the Union. But more to the point, and I'll get to this in a second, the chattering class in Washington, D.C., and this is only in the last couple of months, has been talking more about unions and bringing them back. Chuck Schumer, who's the likely next minority leader of the Democrats in the Senate, gave a talk about this the other day. Larry Summers and Tom Perez, who's the Secretary of Labor, in case you don't know, we happen to have, and believe me, I'm not saying this because I know him, I've never met the guy, we have a terrific Secretary of Labor right now, wrote an article talking about something that is never talked about in the United States, which is works councils and co-determination, something that the Germans in particular, but Europeans generally do, and it's very important. It's really a change in the way the corporation is structured. That's the good news, that actually Democrats are talking about this. And I think that the 2014 midterm elections were very important because it shows what happens to the Democratic Party when they have no message. And the message that they did have to people, education is the answer, education is the answer, that was the message to the base, we aren't going to cut Social Security. That's not working anymore. For one thing, people grasp, not necessarily intellectually, but viscerally, there are some things that you know, what's the medieval theological term, come naturally, you just know it in your bones, even if you don't know it in your head. Education isn't the answer anymore. And it's not the answer for saving the middle class. It's certainly not the answer for people coming out with college degrees. They're finding out, you know, aside from the many that are in non-college jobs, the ones in the college jobs, they're stagnating. And to have economists and professors and public policy people saying, oh, the college premium, that's what, it's actually too high. We need more high school graduates to go into college to lower the premium, effectively lower college incomes relative to high school incomes, that doesn't make any sense. I often think that colleges have it backwards. Colleges and business schools, they have courses, and they're so proud of these courses, on business ethics, how to behave ethically in business, that are all on the premise that these kids are going to become like, if not the president or CEO, the vice president of Goldman Sachs. That isn't what's going to happen. They aren't going to have these huge ethical. What they should be teaching in college is exactly what they should be teaching high school graduates only, that the only way to raise their income is to organize collectively. And it's actually college graduates, to the extent that they've managed to maintain a kind of premium, that one of the effective ways is that disproportionately college graduates, at least in the public sector, are in unions. And that's what we ought to be telling kids in college, not to mention kids in high school. That's changing. So there is this breakthrough in the Democratic Party level. And there's a story about Hillary Clinton talking to her advisors, and she actually, one of the things that she actually has asked about is collective bargaining and bringing back unions. The second thing that's happening is that labor is thinking outside the box. And they're thinking outside the box in two ways. And this is both traditional labor and what they call alt labor, which is this kind of non-conventional worker center things, some of which we represent, by the way, at our tiny little law firm. They're finding out that here's what labor is really good for. It's not really good for winning elections. If the rich really, really have something at stake in it, like the Emmanuel Garcia election, they'll buy the election. What labor is good at is, in a country that doesn't have any electoral checks on the increase in the 1%, it's a non-electoral check. Francis Fukuyama, who's a very center-right, maybe right-wing professor at Stanford University, at Hoover Institute, but really a really brilliant political scientist, says in the end, if you really want to stop inequality, the way to do it is disruption. And that's what's starting to happen in labor. So you have the fight for 15, and you have things like the CTU strike. It's not necessary, and here's where I think I argue for this in the book, and I think it's coming across in the labor movement right now. It's not necessary to win. It's not necessary to beat McDonald's. It is not, you aren't going to do that. Martin Luther King Jr. did not beat the Southern governors. They lost. They didn't win at Selma. They lost. What they did do is they went out and bled, and they forced the National Democratic Party to take a position, to declare itself. And what labor is doing in these disruptive acts is forcing the National Democratic Party to declare itself. You know, are you with the neocons or the charter school operators, or are you with the more progressive wing? And, you know, to one extent, one of the probably victories for the left out of this mayoral election is that Rahm Emanuel himself is trying to declare himself with that group by pushing the minimum wage and other things. It's very important to go out and bleed, and that is what King and Bayard Rustin and A. Philip Randolph were doing in the 1960s, and I believe it is what is starting to happen in labor today. So you see Fight for 15, this push for the minimum wage. It pushed the minimum wage to the top of Obama's State of the Union message. That's what he started with. Not labor, not that was going too far, but minimum wage, yes, we've got to raise the minimum wage. And you see increases in that in different cities around the country. And there's a real chance of at least getting the cities to weigh in favor of working people. I don't think San Francisco or Chicago or New York can, by their municipal ordinance, bring back a labor movement or provide the kind of protection that we need. It's all preempted by federal law. But it's not a bad thing that this is happening. And it is a step towards transforming the Democratic Party into a labor party, which the Democratic Party needs for its own good. It needs for its own good so it has a message for the middle class, so it keeps people engaged in politics. But it also needs it as a governing strategy. You know, if the Democrats are going to be a governing party in this country, they need labor as an instrument of public policy. And you have to think of the labor movement as, in fact, one used to think of the labor movement as just as important as monetary policy and fiscal policy, so was wage policy. And wage policy existed because there were unions that could actually set wages. And wages are something that markets, contrary to what you hear conservatives say, are something that are very arbitrary and that markets tend to get wrong. Krugman's column the other day was actually very good on that point about markets getting wages wrong. The importance of a wage policy is the following. And you can't have a wage policy without a labor movement. Number one, you can manage aggregate demand. You don't have a situation where people have to go in debt to prop up aggregate demand to bring unemployment down to a certain level. It is one of the ways of having a full employment economy without these continued shocks because of asset price inflation, because credit booms, because of over-leveraging. So you need it actually to have, in the long term, a full employment economy, which we're nowhere near to have now, despite what the numbers show. I mean, I think it's down to, what, 5%, 6%? But the enormous amount, and Janet Yellen knows this as much as anybody, the enormous amount, that number disguises an enormous amount of part-time employment. People aren't really fully employed in this economy. So to have aggregate demand, to get to full employment, you really need a labor movement, you really need a wage policy. Second, you also need it, among other things, for your balance of trade. We have a huge trade deficit, which is constantly draining us. I mean, we're unique in the world among the rich countries in having this colossal trade deficit every year, which hasn't been helped even by the cut down in our oil import. We still have a merchandise trade balance that is bigger than ever. Unless you have a labor movement that is able to keep people out of debt, you're going to have enormous incentives for capital to go into the financial sector rather than the production of durable goods that can be sold abroad. That's not me talking. That's John Maynard Keynes. It's part of the general theory of employment, interest, and money, the great classic. And I spend a lot of this book trying to explain why Keynes would be in favor of a labor movement. And some of the problems that we see today are problems that he addressed in this book, but no one talks about anymore. And Keynes has more to say to us than ever on points like that. The third reason you need a labor movement is that we've got to change. It's not just a matter of holding up wages. You've got to change the corporation. So this fissured corporation, to use David Wall's phrase, or the corporation where everybody is spun out as a temp, or the corporation where there's no investment in anybody and there's no career ladder, that has to change. And you have to bring back a labor movement that can change it. And it can't be a labor movement that's just sitting outside talking about wages. It's got to be inside the company in a different way. And that way, in fact, it's the only plausible way, is the way that the Germans have introduced in the West and have been copied by several European countries, which is to have elected works councils that manage the plant and to have workers elected to the board of directors. Not a majority of them, but at least enough to have some significant impact on corporate policy. And the final reason you need a labor movement, from the Democratic Party's point of view, I think, is so that people continue to engage in the political system. So how is that going to happen? Well, it would seem on the surface impossible. And I suppose after you get beneath the surface, it's still impossible. I wrote this little article in The Nation that it was kind of spun out of this book, that said we have three dysfunctional models right now that are holding us back. We have a dysfunctional political model, complete gridlock in Washington, D.C. Nothing comes out. We have a dysfunctional corporate model, this fissured corporation that is spinning everybody out into independent contractors, that doesn't have a career ladder anymore, that is disinvesting in job training. And we have a dysfunctional labor model. You know, the unions have shrunk to 6.6%. They're weak. They're running out of money. They're not very effective at dealing with this situation. To save the middle class, we have to fix all three of those models and do it all at once. But it's not impossible. Let me just talk about the labor model for a second. Now, ideally, I'm a labor lawyer after all. I'm a union side lawyer. I think like a lawyer. I am a lawyer. I apologize. From my perspective, the best thing would be to have labor law reform. It would be to create a new kind of civil rights act for labor, partly because that's what Americans understand. They can relate to it, partly because we have this whole paradigm now of federal courts enforcing laws against discrimination. Likewise, they could come in and enforce laws against firing union members. People want to put on union buttons and try to get a union at work. That is not going to happen until 2020, at least, and maybe it will never happen, since the House is going to be solidly Republican till then, thanks to gerrymandering, thanks to this dysfunctional political model. So what else is there? My view, it's time for labor to think about giving up exclusive representation. And I'm only going to go 5 more minutes. I'm sorry. I told myself 30, but I think I'm going to go 40, and then I'll stop. What is exclusive representation? For those of you who aren't labor law mavens, or really aren't that familiar with labor organization, I have to tell you that the model we have for representing workers in the United States is really, really, really weird. It's very strange. It doesn't exist anywhere else in the world except Canada, which has a version of our system. The model is that in order to bargain at all, in order for anybody to bargain at all, and in order for a union to go in and talk to an employer at all, it has to get 50% plus one of a defined group, a group that is defined by federal bureaucrat in Washington, to vote in favor of the union. And once the union has that 50% plus one, the union then has a legal duty to represent everyone equally, effectively. you know, you're fired, you have to bring an arbitration that may cost $20,000 out of union dues. And by the way, the person that you're representing doesn't have to pay you anything because of right to work laws. This is really strange, and it doesn't exist anywhere else in the world, except in Canada. In just about every other place, Sweden, Germany, Korea, India, Russia, a union just represents the people who are in the union. And they can go in any time and start doing that. In the United States, that's verboten. You can't do that. No, you can't talk to the employer. So as a German labor staffer once told me in Germany, if in Germany we had to get 50% plus one in order to have any wage bargaining, we'd have no unions in Germany. Indeed, you might have no unions in Sweden. That's the system we have in the United States. And it wasn't set up in the law that way. It's just become kind of a custom. And by that I mean, if you go back and look at how labor bargained in the 1930s, you know, the Rouge River plant, the UAW talking to GM, the first contracts in big steel between U.S. Steel and the nascent steel workers union that John L. Lewis organized, they didn't have any contracts that applied to everybody in the plant. Those contracts just applied to people who were in the union under the Wagner Act. It was only over time that it became determined that under Section 8A5, which doesn't really say this, Section 8A5 imposes a duty to bargain on employers. And it's been read as assuming that you can't bargain with employers unless you're the exclusive representative. That's out. It doesn't really say that, but that's the current interpretation. It could be reinterpreted. And even if it weren't reinterpreted, you could go back to a system where it just says, well, look, if you don't represent 50%, you just go out on strike. You can't do that now. So what I'm proposing is a reinterpretation of the law that allows unions to go from this exclusive representation model where they get 50% plus one. They have to get people who are just as soon not have a union in place at all, not because they are against unions, they aren't against unions, they just don't want to be involved, it's too much to deal with, to a model where you're representing the militant minority. And it's my view, at least, especially if you look at other countries, it's not by majority vote in elections, it's not by majority vote in union representation elections, it's always this militant minority that is willing to go out and strike and cause lots and lots and lots of trouble that creates the framework for having collective bargaining. And right now, we have a framework that is just the opposite. We can't represent that militant minority, whether they're 30% or 35%, unless we get 50% plus one and get certified. And that 50% plus one then turns into everybody in the unit. And instead of labor representing a militant minority, it's always representing this mushy middle, a big section of which would just as soon not be involved in anything at all, not because they're against unions, but because they just can't deal with it in their lives. Going to the way other workers of the world organize would be one step. And if you are especially important, if the right to work laws keep spreading and unions are locked in this position where they have to get 50% plus one, which is very, very hard to do, and get first contracts, which is hard to do because they're locked in this exclusive representation system for everybody, and a lot of people are cowardly about how hard to push the employer. If they get out of this system and get into a system where they're just representing the people who are paying them dues and can go not just in these now aberrational cases, but any place in this country where there's 30%, 35%, 40% who are willing to say, yes, I'll back a union and I'll pay dues. You have an opportunity to have much more collective bargaining than we now have. And you have an opportunity of saving what is left of the union movement. And it's also a union movement that is something entirely different. I'm in favor of exclusive representation where you can get it, and I'm in favor of agency shop and against right to work. But let's face it, this is a very libertarian, individualistic country. And the idea of unions coming in and requiring this non-union minority or even the majority to pay a certain amount of dues, strikes people as kind of an odd thing in the United States of America. And it doesn't exist anywhere else. Sweden, by our standards, is a right-to-work state. Nobody has to pay dues to a Swedish union. But they have a much broader scope in their ability to bargain, unlike us. They don't have to get 50% plus one to have even a conversation with the employer. And they have people, they have a far broader membership than we do because they can appeal to more people, represent more people, use a model that energizes that militant minority to get bigger gains than we can get here in, under our system. Why not move to that? And it's something that could be done just by a reinterpretation of existing law, just by the NLRB saying, well, there's nothing that says you can't do it. That's one thing. The other thing is just much more disruption than labor's been able to do before. So that's one way that the labor model itself could change. There are other things that, and because I'm a labor lawyer and wonkish and all of that, I've got lots of other more specific proposals in the book. One of them is about using state law to change the corporate structure and provide for what I would call co-determination. That is, the ability of employees to elect other employees to the board of directors, which doesn't mean that they're engaged in collective bargaining. It's a change in corporate law, not labor law, which means, and I'm sorry to get technical here, it is not legally preempted by labor law. A lot of what the states might do to help unions are precluded because the Wagner Act and Taft-Hartley are supposed to occupy the whole field, and the states have no right to get involved except bizarrely in this area of right-to-work laws. So if you focused on things that just changed the corporate structure and that didn't involve collective bargaining but did involve employee empowerment, not necessarily employee empowerment that was controlled by unions, that is something that occurred at the state level. It could occur in California. It could occur in the nonprofit sector. I know that everybody thinks that corporations go to small states like Delaware where they can get away with murder. But in the not-for-profit sector, there is a great opportunity to pass laws that hinge charitable exemptions on those not-for-profits, big medical centers, universities like Northwestern, hospital centers like Northwestern Hospital, to have some employee representation on the boards, which would dramatically change the attitude of these institutions towards organized labor. There are more specific proposals in the book. You don't have to buy it. You can go to the library. But this guy came here tonight, so if you would buy that, that would be a happy event for me and for him. And I'm sorry to have gone on so long. I spoke like this because when I think about the situation that I was detailing at the beginning of this talk about what younger people are facing, I really think that there are two obligations upon me, which is to do whatever I can in my old age, I'm now 66, to try to bring back a labor movement. Also, deep down, I have a really guilty feeling. I think I should retire and get out of the way of younger people, because we haven't figured out, my generation, how to change it, and maybe they can. Thank you. I'd be glad to take any questions if anyone has them. Yeah, over there.
I've been away from the news for a month, and I followed the BP United Steelworkers strike. I did hear on NPR that the strike had not affected production at all. It's so automated that they were able to use supervisors, and I assume temps, to keep the gas flowing. At the same time, NPR said that it was putting up the price of gas per gallon. Now, I don't see how it could not affect production and still put the price of gas up. It seemed like another anti-union remark off the cuff. I don't understand how this non-exclusive representation would be able to shut down a plant. If 35 people go on strike, all of the steelworkers are on strike, and they didn't hurt BP at that time. And secondly, the contract that's settled, does it apply to everyone or just the ones in the union?
Well, first of all, I don't know anything about the BP strike, so it'd be pretty presumptuous of me to say anything about that. I don't know the details. I don't know whether BP is being hurt or not. I just have to take your word for it. I would say this, that I find it hard to believe that it wouldn't hurt BP if it were being done the way European unions normally strike, which is you go out for an hour, you just walk out. You know, if you go out for 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 or 12 months, they're going to figure out some way of dealing with it. If you go out, you know, for an hour here, an hour there, you can't be replaced, you come back. It's very disruptive. It's one of the strange things about American labor law. You can be fired for any reason at any time. You can be fired for the color of your tie, which I didn't put on tonight, even if you've worked there 30 years. You can be fired for X, Y, or no reason. You know, the boss can say, I have no reason to fire you, but I'm firing you anyway. And it's perfectly legal. The only thing you can't be fired for is if you are at Starbucks and you decide with a fellow worker that you want to go out at rush hour and just shut down the whole thing so that nobody is there behind the counter and the lines go out, you can't be fired for that. Now, they may fire you, but they can't legally fire you for that. So, you know, there are a lot of ways to disrupt companies, and I don't think automation is what's holding back the labor movement. Yeah, this guy had his hand up way in the back.
How do you reconcile public sector unions with these private unions? Because they seem to have tremendous pension protection and tremendous benefits that are still in place. Am I wrong about that?
You are very wrong about that. So I don't know that those pensions are protected at all. And that's a question that's up for grabs. Let me put it this way. If any company had tried to do what the city of Chicago had done, they'd be shut down. I mean, the people would be in jail. I mean, it's just criminal that they didn't fund the pensions at all. I mean, we're in the area of fraud and blah, blah, blah in the private sector, if that had happened. And I can think of all sorts of Racketeering Act actions that could have been brought about corporate executives. You can't do that against the mayor of the city of Chicago. So here we had a teacher's pension fund, which was flush, you know, years ago. And then we changed the system so that Mayor Daley ran everything. Now he just had pension holidays for there on. And we have a complete breakdown of the system. The drafters of the Illinois Constitution in 1970 put in a provision that said your pension is a constitutional right in the public sector. And the reason they put that in, they were very aware that politicians would just promise these pensions and then do nothing to fund them. I would love, as a labor lawyer, to bring the kinds of actions against our public officials that I could have brought against private sector people for this kind of misfeasance in office. I'm serious about this. I really think that there's a case for prosecution of some of these officials. But, you know, they're all exempt, you know, from all of that. Yes, miss, and then up here. The question is whether there are people in the labor movement who can inspire younger people to start thinking about collective actions and so forth. Well, I think in Chicago, Karen Lewis is a good example of somebody who really has inspired younger people. I am in a law firm that consists of 4 lawyers, and 2 of them are really inspiring. They're very brilliant union side lawyers, and they're in their early 30s. And there are, what's more interesting to me, and I'm just talking from inside my lawyer box, when I was a young person, there was something called the National Lawyers Guild, and it was full of lefties, and a lot of them were pretty bitter and into kind of odd things. There's a National Lawyers Guild chapter now, and it's full of the sweetest people. They're all young, they're in their 20s, they're very into Fight for 15, labor stuff in a way that the National Lawyers Guild of the 60s wasn't in quite the same way. It was disconnected from the labor movement. They're happy to be part of the labor movement. So those are 2 good things. I think that things like Occupy Wall Street, the fact that college debt is radicalizing a lot of younger people. I mean, imagine this is debt that you're going to be paying for the next 20 or 30 years in some cases. And while they will pay it off, there are all these stories, college grads can pay off their debt. Yeah, they can pay off their debt, but they will be putting absolutely nothing into their 401ks because all that money will be going into college debt. And this is one of the things I've been saying to the younger lawyers in my office. I'll be damned if you're going to be paying off all your college debt. We're going to, I mean, we should be giving money out to do that, but instead we're shoveling it into the 401ks. You know, let the college debt lay where it is. I really feel terrible that not only are there going to be fewer people eligible for Social Security because they're independent contractors and all of that, but there will be no supplemental savings. The 401ks will become even more of a joke than they are now. So, yes, I'm somewhat optimistic. Well, the question is that Chicago Teachers Union is subject to all sorts of limitations on bargaining that other teacher unions and other districts throughout the state aren't subject to.
Right.
And it's an attempt to emasculate the union and keep it from bargaining over anything. Well, they did bargain over some illegal subjects. And the answer to that, I think, is, well, okay, go get a temporary restraining order and put them in jail. And that was what Mayor Emanuel said he was going to do. You can't bargain over this. You can't bargain over this. They went in and they filed a motion for a TRO. They never went any further with that. I mean, what are they going to do, turn the fire hoses on the teachers? So it's galling to me.
Where were the Democrats, though, in the state legislature, the Cullerton and Mrs. Madigan?
Well, Jerry, I agree with you. But I was saying at the earlier part of this talk, you've got to be striking against the Democratic Party. That was a strike against the Democratic Party, and it was effective, I think, in changing the thinking of a lot of Democrats about charter schools and everything. They saw that the people were on the side of the union, at least the parents, the Black and Latino parents. Well, I think that the CTU was the opposition party to Mayor Emanuel. I think it did carry over.
I agree.
Yes, you, sir.
Well, isn't it true that Karen Lewis's health was the main reason we didn't have any momentum into the election?
Well, Karen Lewis is still with us, fortunately, and I'm very hopeful that she gets better. But you know what they say, only the good die young. So I think there were about five questions in there. Let me start with the second one first, because I've already a little bit forgotten the first one. I think labor should focus on the not-for-profit sector, health and education. That's why I'm talking about laws that change the structure of not-for-profit companies. If you look at what the Department of Labor and the Bureau of Labor Statistics projects as the growth areas, there are a number of different ones, but they're heavily concentrated in health, education. So what are the most militant unions right now? Teacher unions, nurses unions. That's where I think labor should put its energy, because you've got militant people in those sectors, and those are the growth areas. And those companies are vulnerable to different strategies, like the one I was talking about state laws that change the corporate governing board structure in education and healthcare, because they're not-for-profit and they want to have, or many are not-for-profit and they want to have charitable tax exemptions. So that's what I would focus on. And had labor law reform passed, I am here in Chicago, right, like all of you. I have no idea what's going on in Washington, D.C., but I have heard that SEIU was going to go all out in the healthcare sector, which makes sense to me. I think that's the area that is most biggest target for organizing, and it's a huge percentage of the labor force in the country. The first question, will labor marginalize itself? I think labor couldn't be more marginalized than it is now with exclusive representation. It's down to 6.6% of the private sector. Compare that with any other country where you have what you call minority union. They don't call it minority union. They call it members-only unionism. And actually, people are relieved not to have responsibility for being in that 50+1%. You know, it's said about the French. There are only a tiny number of French workers who are unionized, but the unions are very powerful there, very, very powerful, because people are happy to sit on the sidelines and let the minority do something very disruptive, and they'll, if they really like it, they'll go thumbs up. If they don't like it, they go thumbs down. That's the kind of way the rest of the world works. I don't think it marginalizes labor to empower the militants to go out and do their thing, because ultimately, and I'm in favor of management labor cooperation. I've just found out lately that I've been attacked a lot as being too accommodationist to companies because I like the German model. That German model empowers the militants, and it is not something that marginalizes them. because they are fighting for all workers at the same time. And workers are happy to take those benefits. I don't want to get involved, but I'm happy to take the pay. You know, I'm not in the union, but if you're raising wages $2 an hour, I'll take that. You know, people don't really feel victimized when they get a pay raise. So, you know, yeah.
Question, if the militant union wins concessions that apply to all the workers in the unit, do the non-members have to pay anything for the...
No.
So
how do they survive?
How do they get enough money to run a union?
Because of this model, they can reach out to far more workers. They can be present in far more plants. I mean, it's not just an aberration to get 50% plus one here, given our culture. But once you get 50% plus one, the employers think, I've done something wrong. Why do I have a union? And they refuse to sign a contract. So you've got to get into a system where it becomes more of the norm and where it's just, you know, it's... I suppose this is just the right day to say this, the day after Garcia came in with 40% and Rahm with 56%. You know, the left can make enormous progress in this country, and they can get their way, but it's usually not through majority votes. And that's one thing that I've become convinced of as a union side lawyer, and that's why a model that forces labor into this majority vote situation. And look, when the Illinois General Assembly wanted to weaken CTU, they said everybody has to participate in whether or not there's a strike vote, whether they're in the union or not. And they've got to get whatever it was, I think 80% or 90%. And it was so ridiculous an affront. And you had a very effective union leadership that organized and organized and organized and organized for that strike vote that it backfired. But really, that's the motto of labor law generally. It's just not that extreme. But it's constantly forcing labor into a situation, well, you better be careful and you better see what other people think. Get rid of that. Yes? Well, it would be. The argument of a militant minority, isn't it an argument for a labor party? I guess it would be if you had a constitutional system that accommodated minority parties, third parties, but we don't. So the way we do things is, I think there's some advantage in that. Right now, the fragmentation of the left in Europe is one of the reasons that the right is always in power. They fragment a little less. Now that's starting to change with these populist groups. But the left has been out of power in Europe for a long time because it is split into the old social democrats, the Greens, and the far left Marxist types. And it's been very bad for Europe, I think. So I kind of like our two-party system, and I like that we in the United States had our civil rights movement was able to transform the Democratic Party, which in turn transformed the country and the Republican Party. I mean, there are certain things that Republicans just don't say about civil rights anymore because the civil rights movement transformed the Democratic Party, which was the majority party, and we didn't start a third party over civil rights. So I'm a Democrat, so I'm... Yes?
As I look around here, I see that the vast majority of people are elderly like me. We come to things like this, we read books. Younger people look at different media. They look at Facebook, they look at other things. If you're going to persuade them, how are you going to do it?
Well, people engage in collective activity on Facebook. The NLRB has been very, very good about saying that you might be engaged in collective activity on Facebook if you say that your boss is a jerk. In fact, even more profane language than that. You can't be fired for it. And so, I don't think technology is the big deal. There's just always a gap between the old and the young. There just is.
They say even between themselves when they talk about things, when they argue about things, they persuade people through Facebook.
Sure. Well, so why did I write a book?
Maybe in a small way, not for younger
people. The truth is, I wrote a book because I thought it might be a chance to get on TV, but I didn't get on TV. you know, nobody reads books anymore, but you can get on Jon Stewart, and he said, hey, you wrote a book. Why don't you tell everybody? And, you know, you're telling the kids all of a sudden. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. I'm not pessimistic about young people getting radicalized on this. First of all, nothing that any book can say or do will have the impact of college debt. You know, so also the situation that I tried to describe earlier about the change in the corporation, the loss of a ladder, the loss of mentoring, the fact that nobody is watching their backs. You don't have any people, older people, but this is we aren't mentoring these people anymore because we've been pushed to the sides, and maybe to some extent we don't care enough. There isn't that kind of support. These kids, and by kids I mean people who are under 35, so I shouldn't use the term, these younger people are on their own in a way that we never were, and they're on their way, and I mean there are lots of exceptions. There are kids who are cosseted by their parents because they're on the cell phones every day. They're all in places like Harvard and Yale and all of that. I'm not talking about those, the elite. I'm talking about younger people in the workplace. Maybe they're on their cell phones with their parents, but there's no apprenticeship program. There's no union representative there. There's nobody to tell them. And this is something that I know, I think, a fair amount about, you know, representing locomotive engineers and something where there's a union. There's this whole, you take a younger person and you move them along. You know, the older people look out for the younger people in these unions. That's what the unions are there for. And they have training programs for people. None of that exists for young people today, except in these oddball situations. Most notably, the buildings trades and some of the public employment unions. So I think that the real answer is not Facebook or any of that. It's our lack of connection with them. The other thing that they're simultaneously radicalized, but they've got another problem. They don't have, this is what, I was on a flight to New York, and I was sitting next to a pilot, of all things, who's for a budget carrier. It was on American. It was on the big American, not the little American. And he was in his 20s, and we started talking, and he became interested that I was, he asked me what I did, and I told him I represented unions, and in fact, pilots, and he became really, really interested. And one of the things he said that has stuck with me, has haunted me, is that he said, you know, I'm like 26 or 27 or whatever he was. He said, people my age have no baseline. They don't know what it was like, you know, 50 years ago, or they just have no way of dealing with that. So he said, he was a smart guy, and he'd done a lot of reading, whether it's on Facebook or books. He'd read something. I think that is the real problem, that there's no baseline that these younger people have. They know they're getting screwed. They know that they don't have anybody to watch out for them. They know that they don't trust institutions because institutions are doing not one darn thing for them, but they don't have a baseline. They don't realize what it could be like. And Americans generally don't have a baseline. We don't know what goes on in other countries. That's why I wrote the Europe book. We really don't know the way workers have representation in Germany and Sweden. I mean, things that are just are like duh, you know, simple things for people in other countries we're clueless about. So the younger generation doesn't know. The older generation doesn't know. We don't have enough knowledge. So I hope that rather than cursing the darkness, you know, everybody should light a little candle, go out and inform themselves, read books, come to the library, take out a library card. Yes?
Do you think that a big part of this problem has been the way the media has almost censored the kind of discussion about aspects of our history?
Well, I think a far bigger problem than the media is education. And I mean education in the broadest sense of the word. The education you get from your parents, the education you get in the schools. And I spent, it's maybe hard to believe from this talk, but about a third of this book is about education, maybe more than a third. I'm quite enamored with this American philosopher, John Dewey. democracy in the workplace depends upon democracy in the schools, and democracy in the schools depends on democracy in the workplace, and there has to be democracy in the family to have democracy in the political sphere. It comes out of all this democracy is interconnected, and if it's not there, it's in one area, it's not going to be in the other area. They're all mutually interdependent. And one of the things that, and have to be to have a democratic way of life. So what's much more important is, I think, in one's education is, were your parents in a union? Were your parents political? Were your parents politically engaged? What kind of school did you go to? What did they tell you? You know, I mean, in my own case, I know why I'm politically engaged. I had politically engaged parents who had politically engaged parents before them, who had politically engaged parents before them. And they sent me to a Jesuit high school where the Jesuits were completely politically engaged. It was the 1960s. And they politically engaged all their students. And I think that the public schools ought to be doing that far more than Catholic Jesuit high schools ought to be doing. And I talk about some of the examples in the Chicago public school system. And one of the tragedies of, you know, privatization charter schools is charter schools are an attempt to create a kind of replica of what the private workplace is going to be like. You know, to some extent, colleges are. We're going to have low wages. There aren't going to be unions. We're going to have profiteering by the boss, et cetera, et cetera. And you're going to take orders. That's what the charter school is. And they aren't teaching people about political engagement or civic engagement in the same way, or independent thought. And I end this whole education thing with this trip down to this wonderful place called the School of Social Justice in Little Village, which is devoted to teaching kids science, math, all of this basic stuff, but also civic political engagement. It's part of the deal. And those kids, I went down and met them, and I mean, they're just completely different. And we could do that in more public schools, maybe not as dramatically as in the School of Social Justice at the Little Village High School, but we could do a lot more than we can. And we can do it at the college level, and there are people in this room who know more about it than I do. So, but I won't. Well, we just brought a case last week. It was last week. We were representing the Amalgamated Transit Union, and we got a temporary restraining order against the Chicago Transit Authority, which was trying to stop the ATU locals from handing out chewy literature in the break rooms. And, you know, in court during the trial, the judge said, well, you know, what about email? What about this and that? And email lists. What about mailing? We don't have the emails of all our members. We only have like 30% of them. We don't. But, you know, the bottom line is that it makes one big heck of a lot of difference for have me or if I'm a rail worker and you're the union officer and you're there coming in and you hand me a literature and I know who you are. You're Jane, you know, who I've known for years, et cetera. And you say, Chewy, he's one of us, vote for him. That is far more impact on me than any email or any literature I get in the mail. Well, we got the TRO, so. Yeah, they did hand out the literature in the break room.
Great case, very cool.
So, but I'm bragging about our firm. It was the younger lawyers who did it, not me, so I can't take credit for it.
Good case.
Thank you all for coming.